They're afraid of just letting things go and letting things flow. They want to control lots and lots of things. So we actually stop controlling. You can't do that until you can overcome that sense of fear. Fear what's going to happen in the future. And you learn how to adapt rather than to control. Not to have fear, but to have a sense of adventure. Remember, the people who are afraid always live in a tight box, and they're just too scared to go out, to experiment, to try new things, to go new places, to do things differently. And you find that when you overcome that fear, you overcome the sense of control. And that thing which we recognize as an ego just disappears. In other words, you can just adapt, you don't have to prove yourself, you don't have to defend things, and just go out and see what happens. So you find that the ego is built out of fear. So just if you just let that fear disappear, you don't worry about success or failure. You don't worry about what other people think of you. You don't judge. Then the fear vanishes, and when the fear vanishes, so there's a sense of ego. You just be. You make a mistake, then you just laugh. I learned as a school teacher, if you make a mistake in front of the class and everyone starts laughing, make sure you laugh as well. Because when you laugh, when the children are laughing, then the world will never laugh at you. It only laughs with you. And it changes the whole idea of like ego. And ego is when people laugh at you, you forget to laugh as well. And you feel so embarrassed. So if you make a fool of yourself, I say something wrong, I laugh as well. Then we always laugh together. And so there's no sense of shame. There's no sense of ego. So this is actually one way you can overcome that ego. Another way you overcome that ego is, I always say this when we do Buddhist marriage ceremonies. Because I have fun at doing Buddhist marriage ceremonies, especially giving people advice when they're about to get married. Because having been a celibate monk for almost 40 years, I know a lot about marriage. Why is it that in so many religions you use celibate men who've never been married to do the ceremony for you? It's really crazy, isn't it? But nevertheless, so there you go, a celibate monk gives woman and man advice on how to be married. So first of all, I look at the guy and I say, from this moment on, you're going to be a married man. You must not think of yourself from this time on. And being a guy, he pauses for a while. I don't know why I always pause. Because I'm okay, I want to think of myself. And I look at the bride. Say, from this moment on, you're a married woman. You must not think of yourself. And she always nods straight away. Much different than a guy. And still looking at the girl. Now you're married from this moment on. You must not think of your husband. Now look at the husband and say, from this moment on, you must not think of her, your new wife. It's called the method of teaching by confusing people. Because when there's a riddle, people pay attention to find out what the answer is. So once you're married, you must not think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. Instead, you must think of us. It's a totally different perception. When you think of your partner, you're sacrificing yourself and you get burnt out in the relationship. When you're thinking of yourself, it's just, what's in it for me? And that's not a relationship at all. So a relationship is not about me, him or her. It's all about us. So you see the sense of ego is disappearing. It's not about me anymore. It's about us. And that's one of the reasons why things like marriage always have a spiritual dimension. You're letting go of something. That's why they want priests and monks to be there with them when they make this transition. And to test them, I say, well, okay, if it's about us, if it's a problem in your marriage, whose problem is it? Our problem, yes. But what happens in the real marriage? It's his problem. It's her problem, or it's my problem. And that's why you don't find solutions. But if it's our own problem, you find solutions together. So that way, you lose a sense of ego. As you realize it is us, we're in it together, so we fix it up together. That's one way of lessening your ego. We're in it together, we're not separated. So that's one way anyway. Let go of fear. That's why many men are afraid of marriage. They lose control. Women too. You have to let go. That's the last sort of half the question. Okay, we're just having a discussion before we begin. It's got half an article. Good one.
Okay,
yes, sir. Okay.
So, Grandson, in Buddhism, in Pali, it says, my first soul after I knew.
Is like the identity from your previous life to this life. That was the context there. That your previous existence. Are you the same as that previous person? Are you different? He said, not the same, not different. So I'll use the simile of the mango. I being a nature, I love mangoes. So when you have a mango to eat, you eat that mango, and you take the seed, you plant it in the ground. Maybe not in Ontario, it's too cold. But maybe sort of places like Australia, where it's nice and warm, or California, or Sri Lanka, or where you come from. You plant it in the ground, and you can see, you know, that mango splits as a little seedling, a little plant pushes up, it starts to germinate. It pushes up through the soil, you can see this tiny, like a blade of grass coming through the soil. You can see that grow and grow and grow until it starts to get wooden at the bottom. A small sapling, you can see it grow, grow, grow. There's a small bush and a small tree. And the tree gets thicker and thicker and taller over the years. And it throws out branches, and the branches thicken, the bark thickens, it gets taller. And after a while, it throws out the leaves, and the leaves throw out these little flowers, the blossoms. They get pollinated. You see the base of them swell and swell and swell into a new mango. When you taste that new mango, it tastes similar to the one before. But is that new mango the same as the old mango? It's not the same, but it's not different. That's what the Buddha meant. This whole process, even in this one life, are you saying as a little boy your mother knew when you came out of the womb? You're not the same, you're not different. You've evolved. Life is a process. And you can see the links from the time you were a baby, the time you went to primary school, the time you went to high school, the time when you matured, the time when you were middle age, old age. You can see all the links, day to day, moment to moment. There's nothing in you right now which was in those in you as a kid. So in a new mango, it's not even the same DNA, it's mutated from the first mango to the new mango, but there's a connection there. It's not the same, it's not different. Just like the old mango may have been drought resistant, and the new mango is likely to be drought resistant. Your character doesn't change that much from life to life. Not the same, not different.
Anyone got any interesting questions, funny questions, confronting questions? The more difficult, the more fun.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I've read in the Muslim, they say human birth is so rare.
Human what?
Birth.
Birth, yes.
That is like a blind circle.
That one, yes.
Yeah. And so the chances are so little. If that's the case, how can the population explosion
Well, these days you can actually go on Google Earth and you can find out where the turtle is and where the yolk is, with GPS tracking, the turtles can find out where the yolk is. They can put their head through it very simply. Modern technology has solved that problem. Because this is a story from the time of the Buddha. The chance of a human life is so unlikely as if there was like this tire, circle, and a blind turtle, just by chance, happens to be in the same place in the ocean and puts their head through it. That's how unlikely it is. But that was a time when there weren't so many human beings around. Now there is, the population has exploded so much. There are so many rooms in the hotel. It's easy to get a booking. So there's so many rooms available now, it's very easy to get people as a human being. In the time of the Buddha, there's very few human beings around, that's why it's so rare. And now the times change. It's like in those days there was only one yolk in the ocean. Now there's so many yolks in the ocean, it's easy for the turtle to put their head through. Human birth has never been easier. Because there's many more humans. And where all those humans come from? People always ask that question when they talk about reincarnation. How can you have reincarnation when it's a scientific truth that there's more human beings alive today than there's probably ever did? It's just a simple mathematics. I think if a woman has more than 2.2 kids, then it means there's more people alive today than there ever did. So where does everyone come from? If people have been reincarnated, where do they come from? Because you can't explain where does everyone come from. There haven't been as many people died as there are living today. And the answer is obvious. Human population has exploded. The animal realm has decreased. So it's obvious. The new human beings, they come from the animal realm. That's when you have a kid, that's why you call them little monkeys. Because they probably were monkeys. That is why you only have to go out of the streets late on a Saturday night in Toronto. You can understand the behavior of young people. They're animals, reborn. It's not the young people here, of course, who are well behaved. You were human beings before. Because you like people who misbehave. So, when your partner behaves like an animal, the chances are they were an animal before. But number two, I mean, look, don't put down animals. Animals can be very close to human beings. And I've already told someone in the previous talk, if you want to see this, just get on Google and type in the words Alex the Parrot. If you haven't seen that before, it's well worth seeing. Alex the Parrot was an African grey parrot who is a psychologist in St. Louis, south of the border, who had developed a method of teaching English to kids who are intellectually disabled. So a way of teaching intellectually kids to speak English. And they use the same techniques to train an African grey parrot and English vocabulary. And you've all seen parrots, you know, say a few words, you know, pieces of bait or pretty Polly or some even worse words. So because of that, the parrots can imitate human voice. They taught this parrot a vocabulary. And then to their amazement, they found the parrot using the vocabulary intelligently. And you can have conversations with the parrot. And it's freaky, because when you first see this, you think this is just like Hollywood, this is special effects, it's not, it's real. And the parrot also shows attitude. In one movie, or one clip, he's being asked questions, and he says, I'm bored of this, and stalks away and turns around and refuses to answer. And that's actually spooky. This is a parrot who obviously displays intelligent behavior because he can speak to you. We always thought if animals could speak, what would they say?
and they behave just like human beings. Which shows you there's not that much difference between the human realm and the animal realm. Especially, this was supposed to be a science, Buddhism science lecture. The person who developed this classification called species was this European scientist called Linnaeus, and he had his methodology worked out traits in the different animals of this planet Earth. And so how do you classify them into one species rather than another species? And being a scientist, he used that methodology without preference to every species of animals until he came to this group of gorillas, chimpanzees, and human beings. And his methodology actually showed that these were one and the same species. But he realized, because of the culture of the time in Europe, if he equated human beings with monkeys and gorillas, his research would not be accepted. So he broke his own rules and separated out Homo sapiens from the primates. Even though he knew he was breaking his scientific integrity, and he did that to get his research accepted. He knew and later published, according to the way we classify species in our modern universities, human beings, gorillas and chimpanzees are one and the same. There's not that much difference. In our cultures, we started off, in my culture, England, we started off as the English were superior to everybody else. If you're in China, the Chinese were the middle kingdom. In Sri Lanka, there's a home of Buddhism. We are the superior. And later on, we started including other people. We stopped this terrible racism. You know, that all races were all basically the same. And then we had genderism, where males were superior than the females. Mostly we've got rid of that in most of our cultures, but there's still lingering discrimination against the females. And now we're starting to include gays, lesbians and transgenders. But as many people have pointed out, we still suffer from speciesism. That somehow or other, human beings are so superior to the animals, we become mistreated. Just like we mistreated like African slaves. They weren't real humans, so you could beat them, torture them, kill them, because they weren't the same as us. We still have that discrimination against the animals. We never lose the animals, but we lose the human beings, because we think they don't feel. When animals start to talk, it changes your whole perception. And it also answers the question, how a being can be reincarnated, reborn from animals, or back to being animals. There's not that big difference. So be careful. The next time you have a steak, that it could be your grandmother you're eating.
Any questions before we start?
And if the steak is tough, you know why? My grandmother. I still call it too.
Yeah, we still have time.
Yeah.
Do you have any questions before we start?
Yeah, just have it tough.
When I was in Venus, at that time, the essence of Buddhism says, let go.
Every Buddhism says, let go, yes. That's why in our temples, we never have donation boxes in our temples in Perth. We don't have donation, we call them letting go boxes.
But being not trying to study and do undergraduates and postgraduates, it's always a conflict in my own head. If I'm to let go and I cannot have ambition, how do you balance the two in Buddhism and how do you progress?
How you progress is there's the time But some thoughts in our story here. Sometimes you have to let go of the right thing when you make progress. So climbing up a ladder, you have to reach on to the rung above you to pull yourself up. But you also have to let go of the rung below you, otherwise you'll never rise. There comes a time when that rung on the ladder which you were once grasping onto and holding is now the one you're standing on. Now is the time to let go of that rung. So we actually do. We cling on to one thing so we can let go of another thing as we rise and rise and rise. So as you're studying, you have to let go of many things to gain higher things. And if you know how to do that, then you will succeed. To let go of one thing to get something more beautiful and more important. So that's why when you're studying, yeah, okay, you study at university, and then when you get to PhD, you've got to let go of the university and go and get a proper job. Go and take your knowledge out there into the world and help some other people. But some people just can't let go, which means they don't make any more progress. And this is Buddhism and science. To have progress, we have to let go of the old knowledge to see things anew. To let go of the old ways of doing things and seeing things and conceiving of things, to embrace the new. And too often in universities, they cling on to the old traditions so hard and fast, they can't let them go, so they don't advance. You must always stand on the shoulders of giants. I think Aristotle said that. Stand on the shoulders of giants. Never stand in their shadows. There might be great lecturers in this university. People have made great progress in their field, and they cast this huge shadow. And your job is to climb up above them, to see further. Don't just repeat old things. Make progress. I know, what's the motto? Every one of these universities has a motto. What's the motto of this university? Does anyone understand? What does it say? I can't see it.
In Latin.
I don't know Latin. I will change that. I used to know that. There it goes in time, it sounds good. Just say, Junta, you love this, yeah? Junta means joining the young together? That's pretty weird. Sorry? Very good. But, what I want universities to have the motto in English, because people don't know Latin anymore, is where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. Universities should be rebellious, breaking new ground rather than just regurgitating old ideas. So it should teach you to challenge, not to repeat. Because where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. The trouble with what universities, we teach people how to think in the same old ways, rather than challenging people to destroy all the old ideas to get new ones. It should be challenging. It should be argumentative. It should be a place where you're allowed to be eccentric and try new ways of doing things. Research, growth, not just repetition of the same old things. Where everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. Yes?
What form of Buddhism do you practice
to spend
your training?
My form of Buddhism is called the Mahayana. It's a combination of Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana, the three great traditions. So I say the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana,
the Yama or Abhiyama, and that spells Ha Ha Yama.
Was the great Ha Ha
your
teacher?
Yes, the great Ha Ha. Now, you start out with one teacher and you grow. In this university, how many teachers do you have? You just have one teacher, even in your subject, which may be physics or chemistry, you have a number of teachers. Why restrict yourself to one teacher? So you learn different teachings from many others. Synthesize, argue, see what's best. When you boil down all these teachings and you have just Buddhism. Now I'm a celibate monk, I don't believe in sex. Both types, S-E-C-T and S-E-X. All this idea of a different type of Buddhism makes no sense to me. A lot of times it's just arrogance. My type of Buddhism is much better than your type of Buddhism. Some people say, no, mine is a diamond vehicle. It's the best of the fastest. The Sri Lankans say, no, ours is the original and the best. All of that, that's just conceit. When you say that my Buddhism is better than your Buddhism, that shows you don't understand Buddhism at all. So the tradition, which is wonderful to be someone who's so well trained, you know, in Theravada, exposed to all the other different types of traditions. The people in Mahayana, I go to teach in Chinese Buddhist temples a lot, and they say, you are a Theravada monk with a Mahayana heart. There's actually no difference. That's why we hang out together. This bringing people off into sects has nothing to do with Buddhism. Okay, you can read the traditions, you can see the different robes. The different robes you wear is just icing on cake. You have chocolate icing. Now I'm sort of milk chocolate icing. You've got the sister in front of you. She's like vanilla icing with a bit of maybe a berry in it. You've got the Tibetan monks. Where is he? Maybe 2 months ago. He's strawberry icing on his cake. But if you go underneath, it's all the same cake. There are different traditions of Buddhism. As is the coverings, the rituals are different. The essence is the same. That makes sense? Do you agree with me?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We have 2 books for sale if you like to buy. Yeah, one is called The Art of Disappearing. So if you learn this,
if you buy that, your money disappears.
The second one is called Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Each one is $20 and it goes to the Chamber fundraising project.
And both of those books come with a money back guarantee. If you don't get it right after reading those books, you are allowed to ask for your money back. I promise you, you're allowed to ask for your money back. You won't get it back, but you're allowed to ask.
If you have any questions, I can get the mic on.
Oh, there you go. Well, you've got one way to run there. You can get it. It's a question from the higher realms. It must be a good question.
I'd like to know how you would reference science and Buddhism as areas where science might be still, where science is silent, and Buddhism produces or basically interesting idea where science might not necessarily accept as found it. I'd like to know how you would feel to reconcile those two mindsets.
Exactly, that's the subject of tonight's talk.
So if I answer your question now in 5 minutes, everyone will have to go home. There will be no talk. So that is coming soon. So just be patient. And everything will be revealed. The relationship between Buddhism and science is coming soon in the lectures here to near you. This one. So I was just going to hold on to that question. That's the subject of tonight's talk.
Ajahn, I have a question. Is there no value in traditions? Are you not making a mockery of the evolved traditions with your haha Jnana Buddhism?
Yeah, I think traditions sometimes could hide the teachings. And this is one reason why you find all the great teachers, even in Ajahn Chah, would innovate. If a tradition is helping, fine. If it's hindering, it has to be changed. But I came from a university which was steeped in traditions. Now Cambridge. And because of that, it was failing to innovate. Some traditions were wonderful, like the college tradition, where all the students were staying in a college with academics. So you got to socialize with your lecturers, with your professors, and some were noble laureates. So that interaction between the student and the professor helped both. As a student, you were inspired. You got to meet these great masters and mistresses. And as an academic, you got all these crazy ideas from the students. That's where they got the innovation from. From young minds who hadn't been trained to think in a narrow life. So it worked. That was a great tradition. They had other traditions which were stupid. Like, I went to the scholars' dinner every year, because I was a scholar at Cambridge, where everybody got blind drunk, including his great professors. And that was bacchanalia gone berserk. Now, we started off with sherry in the old library, built by Sir Christopher Wren, served by butlers in tails. And there was a huge table, an oak table, worth a fortune, and the butlers were going round in a clockwise direction. And being a mathematics student, I realised if I went in an anti-clockwise direction at the same speed, I would meet the butler twice on every circuit rather than just once, thereby being able to get twice as much sherry as my friends. So that was the result of my academic brilliance in maths. And then we went for a 9-course meal. And every course, you had a different wine. And the butlers were holding while you arrived, which is where the butlers should serve you. And every your glass was actually under half. You would fill it up again. Having finished the 9-course meal with 9 different types of wines, we went to the old library where we had 3 big glasses for port, sherry and Madeira. And we also had this big silver goblet encrusted with jewels that were worth a king's ransom and college heirlooms, which was filled up with port. And every one of us, including the students and the professors, had to do a verse in Latin and then drain the goblet in one gulp. That was tradition. And of course I did that, and I only did that once. It was so stupid. I was blind drunk afterwards. I didn't remember much of what happened the rest of the evening. And that was supposed to be the tradition in a wise college.
Yeah, but I can't imagine that a serious student would regard that as a worthwhile tradition.
They all went. Pardon me? They all went, including the lecturers and professors.
Yeah, it sounds more like a fraternity.
Yeah, this was a college. This wasn't the kids. Yeah. This was the professors, the lecturers, noble laureates, the master as well had to go. He was a noble laureate in chemistry.
No, I'm thinking of something quite different. In Theravada Buddhism, for instance, they teach that death consciousness is immediately followed by rebirth consciousness. And precisely at that point is where Tibetan Buddhism inserts the garden.
And exactly, that is not Theravada Buddhism, that's Abhidharma. And if you look at Theravada Buddhism, you're going to get so quite specific here. Look at Theravada Buddhism in the Vinaya, in the Shuddhavada, where it mentions the first council, where historically they say after the Buddha passed away, Mahakasapa and 499 Arahats met together to try and bring together the teachings, to codify them, because one person heard one thing, another person had heard another thing. Give the teachings a cohesion and authority. And then it says very clearly that the Buddha, Venerable Rupali, taught the Vinaya, and Ananda recited the five Nikayas, the Paccinikaya, which everybody knows is Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anuttara Nikaya, Buddhika Nikaya. There's no mention at all of Abhidharma, not at all. And one of my mentors, Professor Warner of Cambridge, he was an expert in ancient Indian verse. And you can actually tell by the language, the way the Pali was written, roughly the age of that text. In the same way, if I gave you a text of, say, Chaucer, Charles Dickens, and Harry Potter, you wouldn't need to be an expert to know which was early, which was more contemporary. But so the language changes, the vocabulary, the way it's put together changes with time. So it's very easy to use such analysis to prove conclusively the Buddha never taught Abhidharma. Now I know that some people object to that, and this is where traditions stand in the way of truth. It's very clear, you can argue it convincingly, the Buddha never taught Abhidharma. And that's where you find that statement that rebirth happens immediately after death. If you look at the suttas, what the Buddha actually taught, there is such a thing as an antaratara, an in-between state. It's made very clear in the progress of a non-return, an anagami, before they pay the bar. They say there's, I don't know how many types of, seven or types of anagamis. One, Parinibbana's case for enlightenment on the way to the Suttavasa, in the actual Bhava. Just like a hot spark from a heated piece of metal when it's struck, flies up into the air and is extinguished before it hits the ground, on the way. That is conclusive evidence of an actual Bhava. Tibetan Buddhism and real Theravada Buddhism agree on that. There is an in-between realm. Abhidharma Buddhism does not. And Abhidharma is not the word of Buddhism.
Well, that's interesting, because the Abhidharma is considered part of the
Tripitaka,
is it not?
It was. Tripitaka means the three baskets. But if you look at the, and all of the different dissensions of the Vinaya, it's not just the Theravada ones, the Mahayana ones, it's, you know, you have the Mahasamyaka Vinaya, the Sarvastivada Vinaya is still, you can get a hold of that. In all of them, it all says they taught the Panchanikaya, the five suttas, sections of suttas. No mention of Abhidharma at all. In fact, I'm going into sort of some specifics for you. In the Bodhisattva Sutta, that's in the Vajrayana, it's well worth reading there, because that's one of the only other places they mention Abhidharma in the suttas. There it's about the forest monks. Now you know, many of you know, who know your Buddhism, there were two main traditions in the sense of the monks who lived in the cities and the forest monks who lived in the jungles, meditating, living so simply. And these were the Buddha's talking about the duties of the forest monk. One of them said, a forest monk should know more about Abhidharma and Abhidhinya than a city monk. Obviously, it doesn't mean these texts which you learn, because those are learned by monks who live in the city. It also mentions Abhidhinya as well as Abhidharma. And it's quite clear when you read that passage, it's saying that what the real Abhidharma was in the beginning was a sort of deeper understanding of the nature of the body, the nature of the mind, which is gained through meditation. In the same way, the Abhidharma is a deeper restraint on the forest monks. When you understand that, you understand what the Abhidharma was in the time of the Buddha was very, very different from the books we have now.
But thank you, sir, for that question, because it's really good. This is where tradition starts knowledge.